It is only a tragedy when we have misunderstood or confused it or rejected the lesson which it contains for ourselves. To say this means nothing except perhaps to stimulate a little thinking along these lines. Behind the saying of it, there has to be a total philosophy to sustain it. And that is why philosophy is important. It is a way in which we convince ourselves of our own needs. It is a way in which we rationally sell the truth to ourselves. It is not a substitute for conduct, but it can be a tremendous incentive to conduct. And it also can give us the courage to make decisions that are more wise, more practical, more useful to all concerned. Under those conditions, philosophy begins to unfold to us the idea of a universe in which what we call good and bad actually have no existence except in man himself. A universe that is ruled by facts, by truths, by realities. Everything is as it is. And if man will accept everything as it is and understand it as it is, he will find that in this he has a clue to the directing of his own conduct. Now we can take the negative attitude by simply falling into words that such acceptance would interfere with progress. Man is not supposed to accept. He's supposed to roll up his sleeves and go out and make a considerable amount of excitement, whether it means anything or not. Actually, however, by acceptance, we do not mean to sit back and do nothing. What we really mean is that by acceptance, we acknowledge facts and work from those rather than from prejudices. We have to have some kind of a basic acceptance of value. We have to say to ourselves, either this world in which we live is meaningful or it is not. Either the universe is honest or it is not. Either there is a basic integrity at the root of life or there is not. We cannot carry water on both shoulders in these matters. We cannot affirm one thing one day and deny it the next. We must either believe that this universe is a planned thing and that behind it is a creating intelligence and consciousness able to administer and administering this vast unfoldment according to lawful means, or there is not any of these factors, and man is simply a creature of accident, circumstance, and incident. If we take the second position, then we must live by that, which means that we must live with total purposelessness, because then nothing is important, and nothing is less important in a meaningless universe than our own rebellion, so that there is no reason why even the purposeless viewpoint should result in pressure. If nothing means anything anyway, why should we spend all of our time being angry about something, pleased about something else, and miserable in anticipation of a third thing? If nothing is important, then life becomes something so completely ludicrous, ridiculous, that there is no sense in any sense whatever. If, on the other hand, there is a purposed existence, then we must begin to accept certain moral values. We must affirm or assume that this world is an unfolding sphere, and that within this unfolding sphere, man is precariously suspended, largely problemed and burdened by his own inability to understand the greater values of the world, his inability to grasp the total picture of his own existence, and thereby unable to know with certainty the courses of action which he should pursue, is therefore under the pressure of a continuous doubt, a lack of available certainty. Lacking available certainty, he turns to the inner part of his own life, supporting it, sustaining it, and enriching it to the greatest degree possible by recourse to and reference to the great achievements of other times and other ages. He uses the great philosophies and religions of life as guides and aids to understanding. He seeks to know better and to live according to the teachings of Buddha or Jesus or Confucius or Lao Tzu, because he believes these persons have lived well. He tries to draw upon the spiritual experience of his race for courage, conviction, for understanding, and for sustaining faith. And gradually, out of his conviction, he integrates a constructive attitude, which he must then put to work, proving or disproving it. It's interesting, perhaps, to realize that there is a reason why certain great systems of thinking have lived. They have not lived because the Creator was proud of them, that is, the human Creator. These systems have not survived because of the mere pressure of personality. They have survived only for one reason, that in common experience they have proven true, that individuals have found in these teachings, religious, philosophical, principles which when applied are ever true, which when lived produce results which are commendable, constructive, and secure. That these teachings are better than the absence of them. That they have given us a stronger personal way of life, a way of life more likely to produce happiness than a way without these teachings and this level of understanding. Thus, humanity has created its own saints by recognizing and rewarding those whose ideas have become an imperishable part of human good. And in this way, we begin to sense that man is forever experimenting with value. All of these great teachers have united in certain positive concepts. They have pointed out the importance of a dynamic faith. They have recognized the tremendous importance of a non-aggressive attitude toward life, a completely different perspective from ours. We live in an economic and political world continuously aggressive, and yet we live with religions, churches on every street corner practically. Two-thirds of our population nominally religious. We live in a tremendous religious atmosphere of renunciation, of unselfishness, of impersonality, of the acceptance of evil but not the doing of it, and of the tremendous importance of returning good for evil. These things we affirm. We believe, but we cannot operate them in our daily life because they run headlong into the small personal prejudices which are more important to us than principles. Yet therapy lies directly in this level. No one wants to be sick. Very few people can afford to be sick under the existing conditions. And socialized medicine is no solution in the sense that it will not give back to the individual his proper energies, even if it helps him to pay the bill for his mistakes. In the sense of paying the bill, it does help, but it does not solve the problem. The problem lies not in getting well, but in staying well in the first place. And these great philosophies that we have known, as Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, Muslimism, Taoism, Confucianism, Hinduism, these great philosophies have been in common agreement. And millions of human beings, hundreds of millions, living under them, for the last 2,500 years have discovered as factual experience within themselves when they have been able to be big enough and strong enough to live these principles, that in the recognition of a non-combative, non-competitive code lies the health and security of the people. That we are not ever going to attain peace, happiness, serenity, or security by a constant psychic pressure, by constant irritation and agitation. But we are going to find the solution to our problems in the integration of our own resources. Assuming for a moment that we will acknowledge with Western man, even though Eastern man is not entirely of the same opinion, that there are many problems that can be solved with good thinking, that real thoughtfulness and real regard, friendship, thoughtfulness, and affection, simple, direct, sincere, these will solve many problems. But how are we going to have any of these qualities, simple and sincere, while we remain totally complicated, the victims of pressures from within our own psychic natures, eternally destructive of simplicity and sincerity and affection and regard? How are we going to dislike people often enough and long enough to attain this serenity we talk about? How are we going to complain our way into peace of mind? Or how are we going to scandalize our way into security? We cannot. And to achieve our ends, we have to begin to reintegrate our own basic standard of values. Before we can permit any positive value to grow, we must, to a measure at least, escape from the pressure of negative value. If we are going to have a beautiful garden, we must first clear the land. For if we leave all the weeds and the stumps there, our flowers will not grow well. And after we've planted the garden, if we wish it to become a beautiful garden, we must take care of it. We must see that the plants receive nourishment and water, and that they are planted according to their own natures, some in the sun and some in the shade, so that each is given the opportunity to be itself. If we do not use this care and this thoughtfulness, we have no right to resent the universe if our garden does not grow well. And in our own thinking, in our own living, before we can create a constructive philosophy of life, we've got to get the weeds out of our own consciousness. And these weeds are hate and fear and doubt and jealousy, suspicion, egotism, over-possessiveness, over-ambition, envy, and such attitudes as must always reap a whirlwind. All of these actions and attitudes must end in trouble. If we want to be out of trouble, therefore, we must prevent the continuance of these attitudes. Now, we can't just simply say to ourselves, let's stop being jealous. Unfortunately, we have nursed these negatives so long that we can no longer control them. They control us. We are the victim of habits. And these habits are those of negation. The only way we can escape from these habits is to understand through them by giving ourselves a point of view or a perspective acceptable to ourselves. We must sell ourselves something better in order to unsell ourselves about something worse. Our new attitude must arise because we have a new and better conviction about value. The moment the conviction is established, that which is inconsistent with it falls away. The only reason we're in trouble is because our conviction is on a level which causes trouble. When this center of conviction changes to another and better level, the trouble falls away. We cannot escape jealousy and fear and all these pressures simply by denying them or by attempting to frustrate them violently in our own natures. But we can gradually become educated. We can gradually find out what true learning means, and that learning is really helping to build higher levels of conviction, giving us better instruments with which to estimate values, giving us stronger inducements to seize and think straight, and through the straightening out of our own crooked thoughts, relieving ourselves of the pressure of convictions that are essentially wrong. Thus, by degrees, we can create a new level of action. And this new level of action must precede any change in our living. As long as we remain the same, our condition will remain the same. No individual, simply by wishing without doing, will change the pattern of his life. If, then, we wish to get a truly secure position, we have several possibilities. We all know, for example, the peculiar effect of intelligence upon audacity. It has been observed and noted for a long time that to get a person who is really a man of action, you've got to get a stupid one. When you want to get a real world conqueror, like Adolf Hitler, you must get a little man who has never left home. You must get an individual with a closed mind and a comparative lack of capacity to think. The moment the individual begins to think seriously, he is less sure of himself. Thinking, in other words, does not create egotism primarily. It has a tendency to create fear. The reason being that the more we think, the bigger the world looks and the smaller we look. The individual who hasn't thought at all has a solution for everything and will never know whether it will work or not because he has no way of applying it and no instruments suitable to experiment with his own ideas. But the moment we study humanity, we suddenly realize that the universal panacea is extremely difficult. The more we know about people, the less certain we are what will help them. Thus we pass intellectually into a kind of uncertainty. An uncertainty which causes the contemplative person to be accused of being non-active. Actually, he may become so, but not necessarily as the result of contemplation. Because contemplation has as its real end the conservation of energy. Its purpose is to recognize that you cannot attack 10,000 problems like Don Quixote de la Mancha, lancing windmills, that you cannot go out on a knight errantry of reforms simply attacking this evil and then that evil and finding that for every head of evil you cut off, seven more grow, as in the Greek myth. The contemplative person is looking to find the root. He realizes that if he can discover the basic common denominator of trouble and can attack that, that with one clear decision, one clear discovery, he can uproot 10,000 evils. That behind all of the mistakes we make, there is one basic tendency to make mistakes. That behind all of the wrong thoughts, wrong emotions, and wrong actions that exist in the world, there is a fallacy. And that this one fallacy must be attacked in some way. That the only answer lies not in tearing the leaves off of the tree, one by one, for they will grow again next year. If the tree is poisonous or injurious. The only way to get at it is to chop it down at the root. Otherwise, you cannot remove it. You cannot end it. So the contemplative life turns away from a non-valid action that we are all guilty of. This action of trying desperately to fight particulars, and causes us to turn to the contemplation of those great general principles which are responsible for all the particulars we do not like. And as we go further and further into these problems, we realize that error, as we know it, stems from a wrong concept, a wrong premise, a wrong attitude, basically, toward life. And this wrong attitude, whether we want to admit it or not, is an attitude of aggressiveness based upon ego, by means of which man is attempting to dominate something that he should obey. He is trying to be free from law, when his only hope is to be free under law. He is attempting to impose himself upon the world, refusing to recognize the fact that he's totally incapable of wisely administering this world he is attempting to conquer. He is trying desperately to cause the universe to be under the guidance of his mentation, when up to the present time he has been unable to demonstrate that with his own mind he can govern even himself. So there are basic errors, and most of these basic errors root in aggressive egoism, root in this concept that we are right and that we are born to command, when we are probably actually wrong and are born to command only our own resources, which to us is not a glamorous perspective. Out of this, then, man has to reintegrate his way of life. What he is doing is destroying him, and he knows it. Therefore, he cannot sustain it, and he cannot defend it. He can only tolerate it. And as it becomes more intolerable, he will have more difficulty tolerating it. What he must have is a way of life rooted in nature's purpose, in the universal dynamic itself, not in his concept of things. But he says, I can't do this because I don't know what it is. The reason he doesn't know what it is because he has done so much agitating of himself that he has never been receptive to value. Man possesses, of all creatures, the only group of truly reflective powers that we know. Man alone is a contemplative animal. And because he is a contemplative creature, he has a power greater than any other animal that we know. But he doesn't contemplate. And because in the production of his contemplative nature, certain other faculties and certain other propensities were limited, man finds that he is weaker than the animal in many ways, less intuitive than the animal, less able to depend upon integrity of instinct than the animal, and at the same time not using the contemplative faculties by means of which his own peculiar existence can be preserved. To meet this emergency, the individual must reverse certain procedures. One of the things he's got to do, somewhere along the line, is to break down this aggressive negation with which he occupies himself morning, noon, and night. This endless fault-finding, this endless cycle of trying to impose his own ways upon others, and also this tremendous effort to keep up with the silly momentums of his time. If he doesn't do these things, if he doesn't make these changes, he will simply go into oblivion with the rest of a foolish generation. He will not win. He cannot. Because the final criterion is in his own body, in his own emotional construction, which is falling to pieces because of abuse. And this abuse will never be acceptable and will never be the basis of health. And as man tries desperately to adjust to one group of errors, he develops another, keeping his entire structure in an endless state of tension. So a constructive or positive attitude in this situation consists in the individual attaining a detachment from negation first, a relaxation away from criticism, away from suspicion and doubt. Not the acceptance of things that are wrong, but the recognition that his power to solve what is wrong lies in the active use of his contemplative faculties. Man's solutions to his problems must be on the level of man, not on the level of beasts. War is an effort to solve human problems on the level of beasts, and it cannot succeed. Each human being has within himself a contemplative power where he must solve his problems by arbitration rather than by violence. When he neglects the power to arbitrate, when he neglects the contemplation of solution, he destroys his humanity, destroys the uniqueness by means of which he has a reason and justification for survival. So we say that the person in these problems, in his daily living, must begin to relax away as far as he possibly can from these intensities, recognizing them not as virtues, but as hidden vices. Perhaps we would have a tendency to correct some of these difficulties if we recognized them as faults, but we do not. We have grown so accustomed to them, we think of them as virtues, as indispensable parts of ourselves. Our right to criticize is a sacred right. Our right to condemn is something that we will fight and die for. And yet neither of these, criticism nor condemnation, solve anything. They merely magnify and complicate the problems of living. If we can ease down on this a little and give ourselves a chance to relax and allow the contemplative level to come through, we will find that in a more impersonal attitude, less dominated by destructive intensity, we are in a position to discover workable solution. Intensity destroys our power to solve. Anger destroys our power to think. Hate destroys our power to love. Fear destroys our power of faith. All things needed to solution are destroyed by their opposites. And the individual who has the negative qualities cannot at the same time sustain the positive ones. He must decide between them. And the amazing thing that he doesn't realize and has never been able to realize is that love is a kindlier, happier thing than hate. We have never seemed to find as much satisfaction in the development of our virtues as we have in catering to our vices. Yet actually, our thoughtfulness, our kindliness, our friendliness, these are the sources of happiness. These are the things which bring us contentment. These are the very conditions we dream about. These are the things men go out in war and fight and die for. Yet, in decision, we do not choose to cultivate them. The moment some temptation to be unhappy comes along, we are perfectly willing to sacrifice our birthright of happiness. Out of the recognition of this situation, we do have the right, if we wish to apply it, of choosing positive and constructive attitudes. We can choose not to gossip. We can choose not to criticize. And we can choose to seek the good in things, realizing always that there is something of good. And furthermore, that the acceptance of the fact of good is the greatest stimulation toward the growth of good. Henry Ford proved in his work with ex-convicts that when you have a faith in a man, you have a greater probability of that man maintaining his own self-respect than when you suspect him. The moment you doubt him, you destroy his faith in himself. The moment we suspect, we create suspicion. Whereas if we have a strong and constructive attitude, we have the greatest and most powerful defense against betrayal. But someone will say, I did have that attitude once, twice, three times, and I was betrayed. Now I'm a hopeless skeptic. I've done things for people. They've turned around and stabbed me in the back. There are a large number of cliches bearing on this point, but we don't need to repeat them all. But the answer again lies in man's ability to detach himself from the things he does. Almost always, when we are so-called betrayed, we are offended. First, because we feel that our own judgment has been wrong. And that's an intolerable situation in itself. We can never forgive the individual who has proved that we are wrong, if it is only by failing us in some emergency. Furthermore, we become attached to the things we are doing. We expect results. We demand results. But we live within so small a reference frame that the only results that we can see must be almost immediate ones. It is difficult for us to imagine that something, the results of which we cannot see, has results. And nor can we be satisfied with the belief that those results may only reach their harvest long after we have gone. We must have the proof of it right now. All of this, again, being the imposing of our own mind and our own attitudes upon things. We do not do things well, generously, lovingly, and finely because we expect reward. We do these things because they are the law, and we either keep the law or die from breaking it. The other person's reaction to what we do is according to his own understanding. We are not responsible for his understanding. But we are responsible totally for our own. And if 5,000 persons fail us every day of our lives, that is no excuse for any human being to become cynical. Let's face it. Because we must live with ourselves. And if we do not believe in cynicism, then the failure of other persons cannot make us do that which we know is not right. The moment we permit ourselves to fall into this error of being discouraged, it means that our faith in value is not great enough. This evidence, by the way, is not so remarkable as we might first assume. There are very few persons who have not been given indications of gratitude. There are very few persons who have done great things over a continuous period of time without recognition. There are very few persons whose kind deeds have always gone awry. What we generally again do is promptly forget the kindnesses that have been done to us, the gentlenesses which have returned to us. And when 50 persons are grateful and one is not, that one is the only one we remember. If we look back over our lives, we will realize that we have not been the continuous victims of ingratitude. We have been the continuous victims of our own attitude toward it. We have willingly and willfully rejected the kindnesses which we should have appreciated in order to nurse the grudges we should have forgotten. Thus, regardless of how we approach it, as Henry Ford found out with his, again, with his criminal, with the criminals or ex-criminals that he took on parole and employed and placed in positions of responsibility, every one of them did not live up to it, but the majority did. And it would be quite possible to build a philosophy of life upon the one who didn't. But that philosophy of life would be wrong, because it would forget the dozens and hundreds who proved themselves trustworthy in every way. The same way, if we are negative and recognize and remember only negation, we can prove it, but the proof is not valid, because it is a proof based upon a minority incident. It is the magnification of a particular. Whereas the men who did respond and did come through represented a generality, a larger group. And their testimony, 99 to 1 perhaps, is the more valid. And in life, the hundreds of good things that have come to us are more valid than the few unpleasant remembrances that we cannot get out of our systems. So if we take our attitudes and examine life fairly, we will discover grounds for optimism. We will find that this world is not nearly as bad as we have forced it to be by our own thinking. And building a more generous, contemplative relationship with life, we will begin to see that we have been wonderfully blessed and protected through countless emergencies. And that also, if we could maintain and preserve the gentleness of spirit, which is our birthright as human beings, we could live victoriously through this span of life, creating good for others and strengthening the integrities in ourselves. So our positive attitudes must arise from a total picture of our own living, when we shall discover that actually we have enjoyed much more than we have suffered. And if we have suffered, it has usually been because we were not big enough and not deep enough to find the value, the basic beauty, the deep meaning, the important instruction in certain experiences. These we have resented. We have resented them because we rejected them. And in so doing, have created negation. If we understand these things, we can begin to build a more constructive attitude and a better philosophy. And we will find that the proof of it will lie in its effect upon our total economy as persons. When the facial expression begins to relax, when the tightness leaves the corners of the mouth, when the nervous, angular motions of the body begin to soften, when we can begin to enjoy the good that comes to others, when we can actually feel a little better when we get up, a little better through the day, as the result of trying, of striving, we will realize that a good attitude is our only protection in life, and that without it we cannot survive. Nature tells us this, and if we are wise, we will obey nature. And watching nature's way, we'll probably discover that we can save ourselves many sorrowful hours, many years of reverse, and many misunderstandings which are due only to our own lack of perspective. So beginning to take responsibility for our own condition and living according to it, we can slowly integrate a really purposeful point of view, one that will help us and strengthen us and give us courage to face the future. Well, time is up. So let's have a look.